Prologue. Ailes and Bannon. The evening began at 6:30, but Steve Bannon, suddenly among the world's most powerful men, and now less and less mindful of time constraints, was late. Bannon had promised to come to this small dinner arranged by mutual friends in a Greenwich Village townhouse to see Roger Ailes, the former head of Fox News, and the most significant figure in right-wing media, and Bannon's sometimes mentor. The next day, January 4th, 2017, little more than 2 weeks before the inauguration of his friend Donald Trump as the 45th president, Ailes would be heading to Palm Beach into a forced, but he hoped temporary, retirement. Snow was threatening, and for a while the dinner appeared doubtful. The 76-year-old Ailes, with a long history of leg and hip problems, was barely walking, and coming into Manhattan with his wife Beth from their upstate home on the Hudson, was wary of slippery streets. But Ailes was eager to see Bannon. Bannon's aide, Alexandra Preet, kept texting steady updates on Bannon's progress extracting himself from Trump Tower. As the small group waited for Bannon, it was Ailes's evening. Quite as dumbfounded by his old friend Donald Trump's victory as most everyone else, Ailes provided the gathering with something of a mini-seminar on the randomness and absurdities of politics. Before launching Fox News in 1996, Ailes had been, for 30 years, among the leading political operatives in the Republican Party. As surprised as he was by this election, he could yet make a case for a straight line from Nixon to Trump. He just wasn't sure, he said, that Trump himself, at various times a Republican, independent, and Democrat, could make the case. Still, he thought he knew Trump as well as anyone did, and was eager to offer his help. He was also eager to get back into the right-wing media game, and he energetically described some of the possibilities for coming up with the billion or so dollars he thought he would need for a new cable network. Both men, Ailes and Bannon, fancied themselves particular students of history, both autodidacts partial to universal field theories. They saw this in a charismatic sense. They had a personal relationship with history, as well as with Donald Trump. Now, however reluctantly, Ailes understood that, at least for the moment, he was passing the right-wing torch to Bannon. It was a torch that burned bright with ironies. Ailes's Fox News, with its $1.5 billion in annual profits, had dominated Republican politics for two decades. Now Bannon's Breitbart News, with its mere $1.5 million in annual profits, was claiming that role. For 30 years, Ailes, until recently the single most powerful person in conservative politics, had humored and tolerated Donald Trump. But in the end, Bannon and Breitbart had elected him. 6 months before, when a Trump victory still seemed out of the realm of the possible, Ailes, accused of sexual harassment, was cashiered from Fox News in a move engineered by the liberal sons of conservative 85-year-old Rupert Murdoch, the controlling shareholder of Fox News and the most powerful media owner of the age. Ailes' downfall was cause for much liberal celebration. The greatest conservative bugbear in modern politics had been felled by the new social norm. Then Trump, hardly 3 months later, accused of vastly more louche and abusive behavior, was elected president. Ailes enjoyed many things about Trump. His salesmanship, his showmanship, his gossip. He admired Trump's sixth sense for the public marketplace, or at least the relentlessness and indefatigability of his ceaseless attempts to win it over. He liked Trump's game. He liked Trump's impact and his shamelessness. "He just keeps going," Ailes had marveled to a friend after the first debate with Hillary Clinton. "You hit Donald along the head, and he keeps going. He doesn't even know he's been hit." But Ailes was convinced that Trump had no political beliefs or backbone. The fact that Trump had become the ultimate avatar of Fox's angry common man was another sign that we were living in an upside-down world. The joke was on somebody, and Ailes thought it might be on him. Still, Ailes had been observing politicians for decades, and in his long career, he had witnessed just about every type of style and oddity and confection and cravenness and mania. Operatives like himself, and now like Bannon, worked with all kinds. It was the ultimate symbiotic and codependent relationship. Politicians were frontmen in a complex organizational effort. Operatives knew the game, and so did most candidates and office holders, but Ailes was pretty sure Trump did not. Trump was undisciplined. He had no capacity for any game plan. He could not be a part of any organization, nor was he likely to subscribe to any program or principle. In Ailes' view, he was a rebel without a cause. He was simply Donald, as though nothing more need be said. In early August, less than a month after Ailes had been ousted from Fox News, Trump asked his old friend to take over the management of his calamitous campaign. Ailes, knowing Trump's disinclination to take advice or even listen to it, turned him down. This was the job Bannon took a week later. After Trump's victory, Ailes seemed to balance regret that he had not seized the chance to run his friend's campaign with incredulity that Trump's offer had turned out to be the ultimate opportunity. Trump's rise to power, Ailes understood, was the improbable triumph of many things that Ailes and Fox News represented. After all, Ailes was perhaps the person most responsible for unleashing the angry man currents of Trump's victory. He had invented the right-wing media that delighted in the Trump character. Ailes, who was a member of the close circle of friends and advisors Trump frequently called, found himself hoping he would get more time with the new president once he and Beth moved to Palm Beach. He knew Trump planned to make regular trips to Mar-a-Lago, down the road from Ailes' new home. Still, though Ailes was well aware that in politics, winning changes everything. The winner is the winner. He couldn't quite get his head around the improbable and bizarre fact that his friend Donald Trump was now president of the United States. At 9:30, 3 hours late, a good part of the dinner already eaten, Bannon finally arrived. Wearing a disheveled blazer, his signature pairing of two shirts, and military fatigues, the unshaven, overweight 63-year-old joined the other guests at the table and immediately took control of the conversation. Pushing a proffered glass of wine away, I don't drink, he dived into a live commentary, an urgent download of information about the world he was about to take over. "We're going to flood the zone, so we have every cabinet member for the next 7 days through their confirmation hearings," he said of the business and military 1950s-type cabinet choices. "Tillerson is 2 days, Sessions is 2 days, Mattis is 2 days." Bannon veered from Mad Dog Mattis, the retired four-star general whom Trump had nominated as Secretary of Defense, to a long riff on torture, the surprising liberalism of generals, and the stupidity of the civilian military bureaucracy. Then it was on to the looming appointment of Michael Flynn, a favorite Trump general who'd been the opening act at many Trump rallies as the national security advisor. "He's fine. He's not Jim Mattis and he's not John Kelly, but he's fine. He just needs the right staff around him." Still, Bannon averred, "when you take out all the Never Trump guys who signed all those letters and all the neocons who got us in all these wars, it's not a deep bench." Bannon said he'd tried to push John Bolton, the famously hawkish diplomat, for the job as national security advisor. Bolton was an Ailes favorite, too. "He's a bomb thrower," said Ailes, "and a strange little fucker, but you need him. Who else is good on Israel? Flynn is a little nutty on Iran. Tillerson, the Secretary of State designate, just knows oil." "Bolton's mustache is a problem," snorted Bannon. "Trump doesn't think he looks the part. You know Bolton is an acquired taste." "Well, rumors were that he got in trouble because he got in a fight in a hotel one night and chased some woman. If I told Trump that, he might have the job." Bannon was curiously able to embrace Trump while at the same time suggesting he did not take him entirely seriously. He had first met Trump, the on-again, off-again presidential candidate, in 2010. At a meeting in Trump Tower, Bannon had proposed to Trump that he spent $500,000 backing Tea Party-style candidates as a way to further his presidential ambitions. Bannon left the meeting figuring that Trump would never cough up that kind of dough. He just wasn't a serious player. Between that first encounter and mid-August 2016, when he took over the Trump campaign, Bannon, beyond a few interviews he had done with Trump for his Breitbart radio show, was pretty sure he hadn't spent more than 10 minutes in one-on-one conversation with Trump. But now, Bannon's zeitgeist moment had arrived. Everywhere there was a sudden sense of global self-doubt. Brexit in the UK, waves of immigrants arriving on Europe's angry shores, the disenfranchisement of the working man, the specter of more financial meltdown, Bernie Sanders and his liberal revanchism. Everywhere was backlash. Even the most dedicated exponents of globalism were hesitating. Bannon believed that great numbers of people were suddenly receptive to a new message. The world needs borders, or the world should return to a time when it had borders, when America was great. Trump had become the platform for that message. By that January evening, Bannon had been immersed in Donald Trump's world for almost 5 months. And though he had accumulated a sizable catalog of Trump's peculiarities, and cause enough for possible alarm about the unpredictability of his boss and his views, that did not detract from Trump's extraordinary, charismatic appeal to the right-wing Tea Party internet meme base, and now, in victory, from the opportunity he was giving Steve Bannon. "Does he get it?" asked Ailes suddenly, pausing and looking intently at Bannon. He meant, did Trump get it? This seemed to be a question about the right-wing agenda. Did the playboy billionaire really get the working man populist cause? But it was possibly a point-blank question about the nature of power itself. Did Trump get where history had put him? Bannon took a sip of water. "He gets it," said Bannon, after hesitating for perhaps a beat too long. "Or he gets what he gets." With a sideways look, Ailes continued to stare him down, as though waiting for Bannon to show more of his cards. "Really," Bannon said. "He's on the program. It's his program." Pivoting from Trump himself, Bannon plunged on with the Trump agenda. "Day one, we're moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. Netanyahu's all in. Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, far-right Israel defender, and Trump supporter, is all in. We know where we're heading on this." "Does Donald know?" asked a skeptical Ailes. Bannon smiled, as though almost with a wink, and continued. "Let Jordan take the West Bank. Let Egypt take Gaza. Let them deal with it, or sink trying. The Saudis are on the brink. Egyptians are on the brink, all scared to death of Persia, Yemen, Sinai, Libya. This thing is bad. That's why Russia is so key. Is Russia that bad? They're bad guys, but the world is full of bad guys." Bannon offered all this with something like ebullience, a man remaking the world. "But it's good to know the bad guys are the bad guys," said Ailes, pushing Bannon. "Donald may not know." "The real enemy," said an on-point Bannon, careful not to defend Trump too much or diss him at all, "was China. China was the first front in a new Cold War, and it had all been misunderstood in the Obama years. What we thought we understood, we didn't understand at all. That was the failure of American intelligence. I think Comey is a third-rate guy. I think Brennan is a second-rate guy," Bannon said, dismissing the FBI director and the CIA director. "The White House right now is like Johnson's White House in 1968. Susan Rice, Obama's national security advisor, is running the campaign against ISIS as a national security advisor. They're picking the targets. She's picking the drone strikes. I mean, they're running the war with just as much effectiveness as Johnson in 68. The Pentagon is totally disengaged from the whole thing. Intel services are disengaged from the whole thing. The media has let Obama off the hook. Take the ideology away from it. This is complete amateur hour. I don't know what Obama does. Nobody on Capitol Hill knows him. No business guys know him. What has he accomplished? What does he do?" "Where's Donald on this?" asked Ailes, now with the clear implication that Bannon was far out ahead of his benefactor. He's totally on board. Focused. He buys it. I wouldn't give Donald too much to think about, said an amused Ailes. Bannon snorted. Too much, too little, doesn't necessarily change things. What has he gotten himself into with the Russians? Pressed Ailes. Mostly, said Bannon. He went to Russia, and he thought he was going to meet Putin, but Putin couldn't give a shit about him, so he's kept trying. He's Donald, said Ailes. It's a magnificent thing, said Bannon, who had taken to regarding Trump as something like a natural wonder, beyond explanation. Again, as though setting the issue of Trump aside, merely a large and peculiar presence to both be thankful for and to have to abide, Bannon, in the role he had conceived for himself, the auteur of the Trump presidency, charged forward. China's everything. Nothing else matters. We don't get China right, we don't get anything right. This whole thing is very simple. China is where Nazi Germany was in 1929 to 1930. The Chinese, like the Germans, are the most rational people in the world until they're not. And they're going to flip like Germany in the 30s. They're going to have a hyper-nationalist state, and once that happens, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Donald might not be Nixon in China, said Ailes, deadpan, suggesting that for Trump to seize the mantle of global transformation might strain credulity. Bannon smiled. Bannon in China, he said, with both remarkable grandiosity and wry self-deprecation. How's the kid? Asked Ailes, referring to Trump's son-in-law and paramount political advisor, 36-year-old Jared Kushner. He's my partner, said Bannon, his tone suggesting that if he felt otherwise, he was nevertheless determined to stay on message. Really? Said a dubious Ailes. He's on the team. He's had a lot of lunches with Rupert. In fact, said Bannon, I could use your help here. Bannon then spent several minutes trying to recruit Ailes to help kneecap Murdoch. Ailes, since his ouster from Fox, had become only more bitter towards Murdoch. Now Murdoch was frequently jawboning the president-elect and encouraging him toward establishment moderation, all a strange inversion in the ever-stranger currents of American conservatism. Bannon wanted Ailes to suggest to Trump, a man whose many neuroses included a horror of forgetfulness or senility, that Murdoch might be losing it. I'll call him, said Ailes. But Trump would jump through hoops for Rupert, like for Putin, sucks up and shits down. I just worry about who's jerking whose chain. The older right-wing media wizard and the younger, though not by all that much, continued on to the other guest's satisfaction until 12:30, the older trying to see through to the new national enigma that was Trump, although Ailes would say that in fact Trump's behavior was ever predictable, and the younger seemingly determined not to spoil his own moment of destiny. Donald Trump has got it. He's Trump, but he's got it. Trump is Trump, affirmed Bannon. Yeah. He's Trump, said Ailes, with something like incredulity.